A Podshape production.
He was a goofy dad, you know. He did all these little funny jokes, and as a little kid, I thought they were hilarious.
Linda Willimer and her husband Darren dropped her father, John Jensen, home on Sunday after a family lunch. They say he was in good spirits, but the 68-year-old has disappeared without a trace.
At no time has he indicated suicidal tendencies. That fall has never sat well with me, I'll be honest.
Well, the discovery of John Jensen's car outside the Lancelin Beach Hotel is a big breakthrough in the police search for the missing Ocean Reef grandfather.
Look, he did have a bit of depression, and I put the light on and then I just saw blood. All these blood footprints, pretty much what it was very in your face then, and there was quite a lot of blood, and I was like, what the hell has happened here? And I yelled out, and I think he was murdered. No, I 100%, hand on my heart, believe he was murdered, because this is my dad. This is my story. This is what happened.
This is Dad's Gone.
John Jesper Jensen disappeared less than 4 years ago. He was a granddad and a loving father to his two daughters. His wife had died, and although he had some medical conditions and had suffered depression, a few days before he disappeared, he was said to be in good spirits and chirpy. Head back to the previous three episodes to hear how the stories unfolded. On Tuesday, the 27th of June, 2017, police make a public appeal for information around John's disappearance.
Any information would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, his beautiful granddad. We just want him home now.
They say it's completely unlike the widower to go out for so long without making contact.
That night, his empty car is found an hour and 17 minutes away in a sleepy fishing town called Lancelin. Police are able to pull CCTV records of the highways on the trip and spot a car that looks like John's. But the images are grainy, and it's impossible to see who's driving the car and if there are any passengers. There is one thing that's crystal clear. It's the car that's found outside the Lancelin Beach Hotel is John's, and he's not in it. Joe Burr is the investigating officer in charge of the case in WA. Joe was instrumental in writing the brief for the coroner, and he told me about the forensics that were done once John's car had been found.
Yeah, that's correct. So we, the steering wheel and the headrest of the vehicle were actually forensically analysed. The swabs were sent off for analysis, and it did come back that Mr. Jensen's DNA was located on the steering wheel of the vehicle. It's not something that we do in every missing person case. It comes down to those initial investigative critical decisions that are made. At that point, I guess they're looking at every possible avenue that this investigation could go down. So I think it was a good decision to take those swabs, because, you know, it wasn't known at the time how they were going to come back, but and what other supporting evidence could be located further down the line that could mean that that DNA swab was important. But we did get a mixed profile on the steering wheel, but that's not unusual in itself, because obviously with most vehicles you have a number of people driving the car, and your hands are a good source on the steering wheel of leaving DNA in that location. So there was DNA located on the steering wheel that we didn't get a match on, but you know, that could come back to anyone. You could be looking at, you know, mechanics, service centres, family members, neighbours, anybody that's been in that vehicle. So the location of mixed profile on there isn't in itself something that we need to be too suspicious about.
So a mixed profile essentially means someone else's DNA in the car. Both the two daughters of John Jensen's DNA were also taken, and they were excluded from the two other matches in the car. Is that right?
So their DNA wasn't a match. Quite often we take next of kin DNA, not only for that forensic purpose, but also for the possible future identification of any any located human remains. So we would usually take the next of kin DNA, and that's an action that should be taken in most long-term missing person cases. But there was no match per se with the DNA that was located on that steering wheel with the daughters.
Both daughters had said that they had driven the car before, but they also said that partners had also driven John's car, and Mr. Jensen's neighbours had also driven his car at some point. So it's feasible that they could be from a myriad of different people.
Anything that touches anything else, you know, you could even, somebody's DNA could be on that steering wheel that hasn't even driven the car. If someone was to shake hands with somebody and then step into their car, you know, the DNA is a wonderful tool, but it's not always on its own something that can be used to solve a case.
Belle told us that she employed a forensic scientist herself. He was critical of the fact that the police didn't retain Mr. Jensen's car for more thorough forensic examination, which he said was should have been tested the vehicle driver's side footwell and its boots. Did you have a view on that at the time?
I actually think, compared to the vast array of other missing person cases that I deal with, they actually went above and beyond what would usually be done at the initial scene of a missing person's vehicle, because what the forensic officer was, I guess, looking at that time is purely from a position of that there could be some criminality involved in this. But the initial assessment of the investigation that continues to this day is that no evidence of any criminality has been located. So if you were looking at it as a crime scene, then yes. If you were looking at it as solely a missing person case where you have no supporting evidence that somebody else has driven that vehicle, then I wouldn't necessarily concur with that opinion, because they have had the foresight to swab the steering wheel, to swab the headrest. We can always look back on these things with hindsight, and obviously certain things have been raised that it would be prudent now to look back and be able to swab the footwell, for example. But the critical decision at the time was that was not necessary, and I haven't seen any corroborating evidence that says that would show us anything different to what we currently have.
Belle also confirmed to me that it is very likely her DNA would have been in the car and in the house, and that her sister had stayed over her dad's many times to keep an eye on him.
Look, there was a mattress that was set up in opposite to where that foot spa was sort of set up, but it was, you know, a bit of a weird spot. But yes, my sister, I'll be honest, she did say that she would go over there and keep an eye on him, and when he was going through rough times and stuff like that. So, she said she was obviously sleeping there, and but strangely enough, the DNA sample wasn't strong enough, because both of us, due to my forensic investigator expert, you know, luckily we pushed for them to take our DNA, because I said, well, surely we should be doing that, especially if down the track, if we do find him, you know, you want to have that DNA on file, right? So we were trying to exclude everyone. So yeah, we've both had our DNA, and but yeah, strangely enough, they couldn't include or exclude her as being the other DNA that was found on that bed.
Police also state in the coroner's report that there was no evidence of a clean-up in an attempt to conceal or deceive evidence.
Correct. Look, there was comments from one particular officer at the time where he sort of had alluded that he did part of his initial, you know, said it did look like there was a clean-up or some sort of clean-up. But at that point, I think he was thinking maybe he's tried to clean it up just to get to the hospital, I'm assuming. But no, it was very much, I mean, the scene was unusual, and I guess they were sort of able to say, no, it didn't look like a clean-up. But it was odd that there was no blood at all found from this one particular area. You know, if he's walked out of the house, there would have been blood either through the lounge on the carpet or through the tiles or in the footwell of the car, you know, especially after driving an hour 17 If his adrenaline's pumping, wouldn't that be, you would think you would find blood elsewhere.
There was no blood in the car.
There was no blood in the car.
And he actually was on blood thinning medication at the time, so his ability to be able to stop the bleeding would have been very limited. So we would expect there to be blood in the car.
It's important to state that we're not accusing anyone of any wrongdoing in this podcast. We're simply stating some points of view that don't necessarily agree with each other. Police are very clear that there doesn't seem to be any criminality involved in the case of the missing man, John Jensen. Darren and Belle don't agree on this point.
I think he was murdered. No, I 100%, hand on my heart, believe he was murdered.
If something untoward did happen to Jesper, there would have had to be a motive, something that stood out and possibly could lead to police investigating a different path, or more sinister path. I asked Joe Burr about John's bank records and his financial situation.
The issue when you're looking back at somebody's financial records is you're never prudent to the transactions or the conversations or the agreements that people have with family, with people they know. So it's always difficult to look back and think that certain things do look amiss. There was transactions, like normal transactions, like anybody's accounts, but there was obviously agreements in place with people, and it's not up to me. I can't talk about somebody else's financial situation, but there wasn't anything necessarily that meant to us that there was any link to his finances to the disappearance of Mr. Jensen.
What we can see from the coroner's report that he's had a few bank accounts. One was with ING and was dormant since 2014. Then he had an everyday account with NAB, and the last time that was touched before his disappearance was the 19th of June, which was 6 days before his disappearance, and the sum was $300.
Yep.
Belle had mentioned in our chat that her dad was a very a creature of habit. He would have the same dinner every night. He would do the same things very often. He would sit in the front room, watch telly. And he would often visit the bank on the same day. And from her perspective, she said that his visits to the bank over the last sort of 3 to 4 months became a little more sporadic and random, if you like, with different amounts. Did police investigate anything prior to his disappearance and the transactions across his bank accounts?
Yeah, we did. We did look at it. We usually look to see what the run is. If a missing person investigation goes long term, we will try and create some kind of victimology, some kind of gauge of that person's life and their usual activities. I can't disagree with Belle. Obviously, I was never fortunate enough to meet Mr. Jensen, and I'm sure she knows her dad very well. So I wouldn't disagree with her assessment of that. But it's impossible from an investigator's point of view to actually determine that any change of activity is due to anything untoward. You know, we certain people are people of habit, like you say, but that our lives change and certain conversations happen and certain routes, you go down different routes to what you might have done before. So, you know, there's no evidence there. There's no evidence that I've seen that suggests that any kind of visit to ATMs, anything untoward has happened that has then led to his disappearance.
Now, Belle, I guess, doesn't share the same view. She has a more sinister view of what has occurred, and I know she shared that with you numerous times. Is there any evidence from a police perspective and from the coroner's report that is in line with Belle's thinking that something more sinister happened to her father?
My heart goes out to Belle and Darren and the rest of the family. Going through this kind of situation is everybody's worst nightmare. And it's hard as an investigator of missing person cases because you can't give people the resolution that they need. And until you can give them the resolution, until you reach that conclusion, anything that happens is not necessarily 100% accurate. And the issue you have as a family member is you never actually know. So I always applaud Belinda and Darren for keeping up the intensity of the investigation and for, you know, looking out for their father and wanting to find the truth. But in reality, I think when I look at all of the information, all of the evidence, I concur with the coroner that the coroner's given an open verdict, but that is to be expected because we don't actually know. We don't have cast iron evidence of what happened on that day, but we also don't have any evidence, in my opinion, to suggest that any criminal activity has taken place and any criminal activity has led to Mr. Jensen's disappearance. When you're looking at a missing person investigation, you look at the criminality aspect, you look at the misadventure aspect, and you look at the possible self-harm aspect. And I personally, based on, and I have been dealing with this case for a long time, I can't say that self-harm has taken place. I don't know that self-harm has taken place. And I would hate to offend the family in any way by indicating that somebody that we don't know as investigators had the intent to self-harm. We don't know that that happened. People get disorientated. That could have happened. We don't know that that happened. But obviously the element, you know, we're a missing person team, we're part of the homicide squad because we have to be in a location where if we determine any criminality, we work with homicide squad detectives to reach the resolution and to find somebody responsible for the criminality. And the reality is, as hard as we have looked and we have investigated this, there's no evidence, I believe, that there has been any of that criminal activity that's taken part in Mr. Jensen's disappearance.
As I've mentioned throughout this podcast, Belle and her big sister don't talk anymore. In fact, I don't think it's overstating the point to say they dislike each other. It's sad, because as I look back through photos of these two little blonde girls playing with their big mountain of a dad sitting on his shoulders at a family holiday in 1987 in Melbourne, it's not hard to imagine how close they once were. We have refrained from mentioning her name in this podcast, which we'll continue to honour. As Belle mentioned, this is her story. We do have a copy of Belle's sister's police statement that was made on the 30th of June 2017. It states lots of facts. The fact that her dad owned his house on Rainbow View in Ocean Reef outright. That he was financially supported by his super. That her relationship with her dad was close and they would see him almost every second day and they would speak every day. Jawn's eldest daughter also mentioned that she would stay at her dad's house when he was feeling low and that she would sleep in a bed made up in the lounge room. Sometimes at those sleepovers, she would take his keys and his medication and put them next to her overnight. She says, as a precaution, in her words to police.
I don't believe he would have ever done anything to hurt himself. He just needed my company.
In point 13 of her statement, which was made in Lancelin while the searches took place, she mentions that she'd taken her dad to her family doctor and he was reducing the dose of Neurontin, the drug that might have added to his depression. We've used an actress to read parts of her statement.
He stopped taking it altogether at least 3 weeks ago. Since Dad stopped taking that medication, he had not spoken again of suicide.
This was not the only statement that Belle's sister made. On the 14th of December 2017, she made another statement to police. It covers some of the same detail, however, it's much longer, and it was made to a detective in Perth. She talked of her dad's immense pain in that statement.
I remember when Dad's feet got so painful at times, he would bash his broken wrist to try and take away the pain. He told me he would hit it because he wanted to take the pain away from his feet. Dad became very emotional in the last year and would talk about Mum a lot. He would cry at different times and would tell me he missed her. He would also just cry about his situation and that he couldn't do anything because of his feet.
She also mentions to police that at the time of his disappearance, he was on around 15 different types of medication, and she details some of his suicidal thoughts.
In the last at least 12 months, once a week, Dad would mention what I believe were suicidal thoughts. He would say things like, "Why am I here? I've got no life. What's the point?" That would be on his low days, but I could perk and cheer him back up. He would also say things in a joking manner to me on numerous occasions. He would say, "Geez, the pain was so bad last night. That Camry looked good. I could have got the hose out." He would also text me and write me messages in private message at night on that game, Words with Friends. He would write things at sometimes 4 in the morning, like, "I can't take this anymore. I can't take the pain." The pills aren't working and my feet are on fire. He would also sometimes call me on my mobile and would be crying, not being able to talk. I would go straight over and stay with him on those nights and try and make him feel better. When I would stay with him, I would hide the keys to his car and medication in bed with me so that he didn't do anything silly. Up until Dad went missing, I was at his home almost every night.
Jawn's finances have been a matter of discussion for the sisters. Nothing suspicious has been noted by police. In her statement, Belle's sister says that on the day she went to her dad's house after he was reported missing, she walked through the house and was in complete shock.
There was blood in Dad's foot bath and blood all over the floor on the tiles. I was in complete shock. I was made aware that the police had been contacted the previous night. At some stage, I noticed that Dad's medicines were all accounted for because they were on the bench. I went into his bedroom and noticed his wallet and hearing aids were on a set of drawers. His iPad was there in the lounge room near his seat. Dad had a Christmas cardboard box underneath a side table in the front lounge room, which contained Dad's cash money. Inside the box was $4,000 in cash, $50 notes, which I grabbed whilst Belinda and were present. I took the cash money home and paid bills with that money. I have all the receipts for the money I spent on bills.
Belle's recollections of her dad's bank accounts, of his financial position, and her knowledge of her father and how he used money is important. As the police explain, it's impossible to know how a family spend their money before something like this happens. Financial affairs are normally very private. Belle is careful about accusing anyone of anything criminal when I ask her about her dad's bank accounts.
That's a tricky one. I've got to be a bit careful what I will say. And I think it's important to say this, and I have it right, because this is my dad. This is my story. This is what happened. The Friday before my dad went missing, I popped in on my way home from work. He was holding an ATM slip in his hand. And he said, "Bindi, this person has stolen my money." And this particular ATM slip, I didn't see how much was in his bank account at the time, and I didn't realise the severity of it. I knew we'd had some financial issues sort of leading up to that period, and I didn't realise the severity of the problem at that time. But I also thought I'd have time to sort it out. So at the time, he only had sort of, I think it was $1,246 left in his bank account. And I would have thought he would have had thousands, like hundreds of thousands. Like, he used to have a savings account which should have had hundreds of thousands in it. And for him only to have just over $1,000 did not make sense.
Both of his bank accounts were bled dry.
Both of them. There was nothing. But again, I was told because nothing was taken out after the fact that doesn't matter.
When you say bled dry, transferred to someone, given to someone?
He had a savings account through ING, which, you know, had over, I want to say it had $100,000, but that's what he used to pay for his holidays or whatever out of. But there was a $74,000 transfer for a holiday, apparently, that he never went on. So we can't explain that. It just says $74,000 transfer, holiday dash receipt, but Bell booked all his holidays and that he didn't go on a holiday, especially not a holiday for $74,000.
Mm. Where was that transfer made to?
It was made to another one of his accounts, and then from that account, a cheque was written out in someone's name.
Was your dad wealthy?
Look, he wasn't wealthy. He was he, you know, he had plenty of money. He even said to me at one point, you know, because it's very old school, you know, it was always, you know, pay off your mortgage first. Don't use the ATM all the time. You know, back in the day when you used to get, you know, fees from, you know, using ATMs, he always had plenty, you know, always had at least 300 cash in his wallet. You know, always, he actually kept money at his property for a rainy day. And at one point he goes, Benny, I'll measure you up to like $80,000. He had $80,000 kept in his, at home. You know, he had money. He could go on all the holidays. I mean, he worked hard as a labourer. You know, he hadn't had a mortgage since the 80s because he built his own house with his own, you know, in Woodvale. So he wasn't in debt. He pretty much just had, you know, and when we were on, although he was a bit of a tight ass growing up, I'll have to admit, but, you know, if we were on holidays and all that, that's when you knew that, you know, he saw me sitting there in South Africa. I was like, I want that egg, that, you know, one of those emu egg things, and I really wanted money. And he ended up just buying it for me, you know. He's like, don't be silly, you know. And, you know, things like that. So he didn't spend money frivolously. He was very cautious with his money. And so he should have had a lot more money than what he did have when he went missing.
Did police investigate the transfers of money?
Look, again, I reported it first to the first officer because obviously after 8 months the case was handed over to Sergeant Joseph Burr. But prior to that, the investigator, I rang him as soon as basically when I got estranged from my sister, there was alarm bells and we had an incident and I was like, oh my god, I got to get a bank statement and I just went round to Dad's every day, and thank God I finally got one of his final NAB statement, and that's when it hit me. What that Friday conversation was all about, because there was a lot of, although you look at it and maybe from the police perspective, no, maybe it doesn't look that bad. But when you see a $50 ATM transaction, when this man's not driving, so he's driven, you know, gone to Whitford's and this man's got thousands of dollars at his house already and he's not going out or doing anything. And you got transactions for 300 and then going back in an hour later and going in another 300 out. What the, you know, he was a creature of habit. He did get it at a certain amount at a certain time, and you could see these patterns change. I've put every transaction into a spreadsheet, extrapolated every bloody report you possibly can, and you can see a change. You see when he was going, it'd go at a certain time, almost to the, like, 2 o'clock on a Friday, for example. Do you know what I mean? And then it turned into, in the last 6 months, there was no consistency, and there were a lot of transactions. And even in that last, since the fall, I think 20 grand had been taken out. And I'm like, why? He had money next to him, and at that point, he wasn't going anywhere. He wasn't playing golf. He wasn't. What was he spending the money on?
Did you hand this over to police?
Oh yeah, I rang police as soon as I had got his thing in, and they came out. They came out to my house, but I was pretty much told that no money's gone out after the fact. You know, so he's basically whatever he wanted to do with his money is his choice, and it was his decision. I guess it was looked upon that I was had animosity, yeah. or that I was. Worried that, you know, someone else was getting money and I wasn't, but it wasn't the case.
Unfortunately, sorry to interrupt again, but unfortunately when you mention money, it starts to sound like a civil matter. It sounds like you're arguing over money, but unfortunately in this situation, we were trying to find out what's happened to a man and this man's money had gone missing. They said two things. They said no money has gone since and that it doesn't mean that this person that we're talking about has done it. And pretty much the only thing we can see as far as the investigation that money goes is one email which was sent to someone, we can't say, and that was basically saying that there seems to be a lot of spending going on, a lot of money going out of accounts, basically. Did your dad owe any money? Did Jesper owe any money? So But that's all we seem to know as far as the investigation went. They didn't want to know about the money. We just got told it's a civil matter, doesn't mean anything.
Did your dad have any gambling issues? Anything?
Oh, God, no.
No.
God, no. If he enjoyed going to the casino, but he was one of those blokes that would just stand there and watch it. You know, he enjoyed just, and you know, but he worked too hard for his money. You know, he wasn't as, no. And he did not owe any money. He didn't have a mortgage. Yeah, straight out to no.
In the next episode, Dad's gone.
And did the psychic say anything?
He did. Look, I didn't sort of get a reading. It was sort of one of those, you know, fairly intimate little settings where, you know, he'll go around reading people and I kept putting my hand up right at the very end. And then he picked me and obviously, you know, sort of started sort of connecting or whatever. And then you could see him instantly, yeah, look quite ill and just went, what's happened? What? And then he goes, was your dad murdered? And I said, well, it's still under investigation. You know, we haven't found his body. And he goes, oh, I can't talk to you about this in front of everyone else. You know, I'll talk to you after the seminar.
He's also shown me people taking him, or people have got him, or there was males that have got him. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People getting him or taking him or abducting him. It's like there's a group of males that have got him.
He's gone, though. He's deceased.
Yeah, no, but the way that he passed, or the way, it's like somebody has taken him or got him. That's what I mean, when he was alive.
There are over 38,000 long-term missing person cases in Australia, and the story you've just heard is one of them. We want to continue to help bring these emotional stories of ambiguous loss to you so we can spread the word and hopefully get some closure for the families. For as little as the price of a coffee a month, you can help support us to keep creating this content. Just head to our Patreon page. The link is in the show notes.